Welcome to Dominion Radio on CKDU 88.1. We bring you grassroots news from across the country, focusing on stories and voices silenced by the mainstream media. For more on the topics you hear about tonight, check out the Dominion newspaper at www.dominionpaper.ca. Hello, my name is Hillary Lindsay.
And I'm Pierre Loisel. We have a great show lined up for you tonight. We'll be speaking with Matthew Behrens from the Toronto-based Stop Secret Trials in Canada. Matthew spoke to Hillary earlier this week about the three men being held in Guantanamo North who are currently in their third month of a hunger strike. Next up will be Stuart Neatby's interview with Noreen MacDonald, president and Southern Afghanistan coordinator for the research group The Senless Council. And finally, an interview with independent journalist John Elmer, who's on the ground in Palestine. But first up, the struggle against waste and racism in Lincolnville, Nova Scotia.
Community on the outskirts of Antigonish, Nova Scotia, are campaigning against a second-generation landfill that has recently opened a few kilometers from where they live. The landfill is not the first that Lincolnville has seen. The community was home to a first-generation landfill for 30 years before the announcement was made that Lincolnville would house a second dump. The second landfill has become a symbol of the slow decline of Lincolnville that residents say is a result of a lack of economic opportunity, plunging property values, poor health, and the stubborn indifference of the municipality. Those fighting against the dump are accusing the municipality of environmental racism and are insisting that if the voices of the people are not heard soon, the community, along with its important culture and history, may be lost. The Dominion spoke to Wendy Campbell, who is one of the residents of Lincolnville. Her family has lived in the community for generations. Hillary Lindsay started by asking Wendy to describe Lincolnville.
Okay, I'm on the phone right now with Wendy Campbell in Lincolnville, which is a community right outside of Antigonish, and she's part of a campaign against a landfill just on the outskirts of Lincolnville. And Wendy, just to start out, I was just wondering if you could describe for me what the community of Lincolnville is like, because I think a lot of people in Nova Scotia and Halifax have never actually heard of Lincolnville before.
Well, Lincolnville is located in Guysborough County, and it's an original black community. Which was established by Thomas Brown Springs back in 1784. And it's just a quiet community. It's family-oriented, and it's a safe community to bring your children up in, to grow old. It's beautiful.
How big is the community right now?
Well, the community has about 60 residents.
Okay. And that's significantly smaller than it was at one time?
Oh, definitely. About 30 years ago, it was over 300 people. The first landfill site in the community of Lincolnville, or just outside the community of Lincolnville, was established back in 1974. So back in 1974, we had about 300 people in our community.
From what I gather from the campaign, that's one of the major complaints, is that the town of Lincolnville has already had to deal with the impacts of a landfill for over three decades. And I'm wondering if you could tell me some of those impacts. What kind of problems has the community been experiencing?
Well, the fact that the first site that began in 1974 was just a hole in the ground. And with a hole in the ground, comes anything and everything was buried in there. People are dying of different diseases. There's new diseases that are popping up in our community, and we're not sure if it's associated to the toxics that could be in our waters because of the landfill.
Over the past 30 years, have you ever tried to bring forward any of these complaints about the landfill?
Well, there was always, the community of Lincolnville always brought these issues forward. You know, back 10 years ago when the municipality of Guysborough decided to bring in the garbage from the Antigonish St. Mary's area, people from the community protested, brought their concerns forward, but however, once again, they were ignored.
One thing that's kind of unique about this campaign in Lincolnville is that you're using the term environmental racism and have accused the municipality of environmental racism. Could you explain what that means?
Environmental racism is just what it is. It's people taking their debris and find an easy place to put it beside people who are low income, low education, and hoping that we want safe bags back like we have in the past 30 years.
So you feel racism is partly to blame for the reason that a second landfill has now been placed beside Lincolnville?
Yes, it's definitely environmental racism because if you know the history of Guysville County and the dumps, the first dump was placed in the black community of Sunnyville. And when a methane gas fire broke out there, emergency units had to be called in. And because Sunnyville is less than a kilometer away from the township of Sunnyville, when they realized how dangerous and what the dangers that they were working with, they decided to move the landfill site from the community of Sunnyville. And when they decided to move it from the black community of Sunnyville, they took it and moved it to the black community of Lincolnville. Now they're saying that the dump is its own community. This new second generation landfill site is its own community. It's now called Mars Hill. However, up until 10 years ago, until the community started complaining, it was always called the Lincolnville Dump. Now they've got a new name for it, and now it's its own community. It has nothing to do with Lincolnville at all, so they say.
Do you find there's other ways that racism has kind of manifested itself in the lives of the people living in Lincolnville and in black communities?
Living in Guysville County, the blacks of Guysville County?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we've been here. We came when the others came back in 1783. And the sad part of it is that when all you have to look around in Guysville County and see the employment, and you'll know for sure that racism is alive and well. We have no one working in any of the offices. Oh, now in the past year, they have hired one black to work in the municipal office. It wasn't until 4 months ago that they decided to hire blacks to work at the dump that's located outside the community. And the sad part about it is there's only one person of color who's got a permanent job. The other two are part-time, and I believe they're receiving up to 15 or 16 hours a week, and sometimes not even that. So racism, yeah, it's alive and well. And until we are seen in some of those different businesses, social services, the doctor's office, the post office, I mean, we've been here as long as anyone has, and we've contributed to the building of the county of Guysville, but yet we're definitely not visible when it comes to being able to dream and doing things in our community or people wanting to being able to stay home and raise their families.
So what are your hopes for this campaign? What would you like to come out of it?
What I would like to see come out of it is that people across the province start paying attention, and the people in the Guysville County area and the people that this dump is servicing, like all of Cape Breton, all of Pictou, to realize that this is an injustice, this is environmental racism, and that they need to hear what the people of the community have to say. And unfortunately, since we began this campaign 18 months ago, the warden finally decided to meet with us last month, they have agreed to work with the Concerned Citizens of Lincolnville and the Save Lincolnville campaign to come together with a forum to listen to the people and the concerns of the people of Lincolnville. So hopefully that will come.
So are you hopeful that the next year is going to bring some improvements for the community?
Am I hopeful? No, not at all. Not at all. Not unless people really start paying attention. The community of Lincolnville is pretty much at its last straw. If people don't come on board and support this issue to pay attention to it, I'm afraid that there will be no Lincolnville. And we live in such a geographic area that the only thing that's stopping the industrial expansion is the community of Lincolnville because of where we live, the mass land, the fact that we're near the Trans-Canada, that we are on Route 16. And little by little, if they don't employ us, then as our youth grade and graduate, they're going to venture on to the urban city. So all you're going to have left is the seniors to stay and die. And as they die, so will the community of Lincolnville. And once again, it'll just be another displaced community with people wishing that they had a home to go to.
When you say that the community of Lincolnville might disappear altogether, what would that mean? What would we be losing?
We would be losing her heritage, her culture. Like I said, we are an original Black Borderless community. We have a rich culture. We do have a rich heritage. We stood united. We stood strong. And it's only been in the past 25 or 30 years that things started falling apart. I think when we were isolated, that we enjoyed each other more. It seems like the more that we venture out, we're becoming assimilated, and now that we're becoming assimilated, we're tending to forget that Lincolnville even existed, or the good times that we had here.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Wendy?
Well, all I'd like to say is that it's important that we save Lincolnville. And once again, and I know Affyville has always been in the forefront, but the people of the community of Lincolnville are truly, we will truly be another Affyville. We will be a memory in time if people don't step up to the plate, politicians and everyone step up to the plate to say that this is an injustice and we need to be heard.
And that was Lincolnville resident Wendy Campbell speaking last month about her community's struggle against racism and a new landfill in her community.
And next up is an interview that Hillary Lindsay did earlier this week with Matthew Behrens from Stop Secret Trials in Canada. Matthew is fighting for the just treatment of three men currently being held under security certificates in Canada at a special prison in Kingston, Ontario, that's been dubbed Guantanamo North.
Just to start, for the listeners who aren't familiar with security certificates, could you just describe to me what they are and when and why they started?
Security certificates have been part of immigration legislation for more than three decades. In their current form, since 1991, they have been a measure by which the federal government can have somebody detained, anyone who's a non-citizen, indefinitely, without charge, without bail, on secret evidence, which neither they nor their lawyers is allowed to see. There's been about 30 such cases since 1991, and individuals have been held for as long as 8.5 years before being deported. There's currently six men who are subject to this process in Canada. Three of them are out on various forms of bail, and three of them are currently detained and on a very lengthy hunger strike at the facility known as Guantanamo Bay North. You know, recently there was a newspaper ad taken up by six former foreign ministers for Canada, in which they called on the Canadian government to criticize the U.S. for holding people indefinitely without charge. But in typical Canadian fashion, they wouldn't criticize what's going on here at home. So how do they expect Canada to be taken seriously on the world stage when we ourselves engage in secret trials and indefinite detentions?
Why do you think it's getting so little media attention here in Canada?
Well, I think it's that traditional, what we call, thousand-mile liberalism. We're very quick to criticize things when they take place in Syria or Egypt, but when they actually take place in our own backyard, they give the lie to this idea that Canada is this welcoming, compassionate country, when in fact, if you look at the whole history of this country, it's founded on conquest, it's founded on genocide against First Nations peoples, and every time there's a major scare or there's a crisis, we scapegoat communities. And you look at the history of Canada, we have scapegoated Japanese Canadians, Italian Canadians, German Canadians, Ukrainian Canadians, First Nations, so many different groups. And right now, the enemy du jour, in the eyes of the security agencies, is Arab Muslims or anyone who is perceived to be Muslim. And it's no mistake that the five guys, the Secret Trial Five, are all Arab Muslims.
So these men were originally in the regular jail system, and they're now in what's being called Guantanamo North. Why were they moved, and how long ago have they been in Kingston?
They've been in Kingston since April. Before that, they were held in a facility which is not built for long-term detention, called Metro West Detention Facility. And that's a jail where you're basically held for a couple of weeks to a couple of months. That's the way it's designed anyway. So there's no programs, there's no special diets, there's nothing for the guys to do all day. And for a number of them, they spent most of their time in solitary confinement. One of them spent 4 years and 3 months in solitary confinement, a 9x12 concrete cell with an open toilet.
The solitary confinement for 4 years, I mean, is that precedented in Canada? Is that legal? I mean, is that fine here?
Well, the question is it legal versus is it actually happening? Is always an interesting one. There's many things that are illegal, but Canada engages in them anyway. So, for example, it's illegal under the Convention Against Torture to send someone overseas to face torture, and yet Canada is involved in trying to send all of these men to countries where Canada acknowledges they will be tortured. So that's illegal, but they're doing it anyway. And the way in which they get away with this is the extent to which Canadians are informed about an issue. But it's clear that anything beyond 30 days in solitary confinement is generally considered cruel and unusual punishment. So you multiply that by 4 years, and we see what we've got.
What are the current conditions that the men are being held under now, the three men in Guantanamo North?
Well, I think most importantly, the men are not being given medical treatment, and they're not having their vital signs monitored on a daily basis. It's standard medical procedure around the world that at least at day 10, of a hunger strike, you have to be taking blood, checking on sodium and potassium levels, looking at electrolytes, looking at what's going on with the body, respiration, pulse, blood pressure. None of this has been taking place at Guantanamo Bay North. The men daily and weekly request to have doctors come in and check on their conditions and provide treatment for everything from a double hernia to high blood pressure to hepatitis C to a very severely swollen tongue. That's not happening. So that's one big issue. Another issue is the men are very much concerned about false allegations being made against them, and they have requested on more than one occasion to have a supervisor go with them when they have to go to different parts of the facility, whether that's for exercise or health care or to take a visit. The men don't like the fact, and I don't see how anyone could like the fact, that when media come to interview them, a guard sits in the room and stares at them. So that's a very intimidating thing. So the free access to the media that they actually did have when they were in Toronto has been taken away from them, as well as the fact that all their calls are pre-approved, and whereas they could call anybody they liked when they were in Toronto, here they're not even allowed to dial a phone. They have to say, I'd like to make a call. Who are you calling? They say the name. A guard dials the call. When the connection is made, then they're allowed to pick up the phone. So it's just incredibly humiliating and demeaning treatment that these men and their families are being forced to go through year after year after year.
With no knowledge of when it might end, I guess, is the most difficult part.
Yeah, and indefinite detention has been described at Guantanamo Bay South as a form of torture. And here in nice, polite Canada, people aren't willing to look at it in quite the same way, but it is torture. And the fact that these men have been held for so long in conditions which are both physically oppressive and psychologically oppressive, that is a form of torture. And I think, you know, the ultimate sign of torture is when you force the torture victim to self-abuse. And I think if we can define 2 months without food as a form of self-abuse, then it's clear that the Canadian government has been successful in its efforts to torture them. And they are being tortured as a result of this process.
And you know these men? You've communicated with them through letters and phone and stuff?
Yeah. I consider them my friends, and their families, of course, are wonderful folks. And it's just criminal to, you know, especially once you get to know these guys, that, you know, they don't have a mean bone in their bodies. They're very gentle people. They're devout Muslims. And all they want to do is get on with their lives. They came to Canada to escape persecution. They came here to escape torture. Two of the men are survivors of brutal, brutal tortures in Egypt. And, you know, they came here seeking peace. And what did they get instead? They got, in one instance, CSIS saying, if you don't spy for us, we're going to put you in jail. When the individual refused to spy on them, he was put in jail. In another instance, one of the guys who was waiting for his landing application, he was asked questions like, what do you think of the satanic verses? I mean, what does that have to do with whether or not you can live here in Canada? They're just regular folks who have been caught up in the hysteria around Arab Muslims. Two of them were arrested long before the events of 9/11, and another was arrested in October of 2001 when the Canadian government was looking for somebody so that they could tell the Americans, look, we found somebody. We're on top of the terror game.
They have some demands that relate directly to the conditions they're being held in now, and then also demands in terms of their release and a fair trial. Could you just kind of run through those?
Well, the hunger strike itself is not specific to the security certificate,
right.
But the security certificate that we've described, I think, really does form the context to what's going on. If these men knew when they were getting out, I don't think the situation would feel quite so desperate to them. But they've been in for so long, and they don't know when they're getting out, that's a huge contextual thing which needs to be taken into consideration. But in terms of specific demands, we've talked about medical care. There's things like head counts. This is a facility that has 23 staff, and there's only 3 detainees. And at any time of the day, they can say, time for a head count. You have to stop, line up, and be counted. That's just ridiculous and humiliating and demeaning. The men's religious practices are not being respected. They're not allowed to leave their cell in the morning before sunrise so that they can bathe and pray, which is one of the duties of a devout Muslim. So that is not being respected. They're not allowed to have trailer visits with their families where they can cook together and have conjugal visits. That's something which anyone who is convicted of a federal offense has access to in the federal system. These are the only 3 men who don't have that. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, these are the only 3 men in a Canadian federal prison who do not have access to something called the Office of the Correctional Investigator, which is an independent ombudsperson who is charged with investigating these very kinds of complaints and producing an independent result. Right now, if they have a complaint, it goes to the people that they're complaining about. So it's not like they're going to get a fair review of the conditions of the complaint.
And what your organization is calling for, aside from the meeting of these demands, is that if the government has evidence against these men, to present them in a fair trial or release them?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, I would imagine after 5 days of this, I would be saying, just let me out, I don't care. But they've been very patient, and they've said, use the tools of the courts, but use them properly. Right now, the courts are not being used properly. They're being used as the rubber stamp for CSIS. And what we need to see happen is, if there is a case to be made against these guys, charge them, give them the opportunity for reasonable bail, and let them see the evidence in an open, fair court of law. You know, one interesting part of the legislation states that the government can enter into the court anything which is not normally admissible in a court of law. Those are the exact words in the legislation. So if you can enter anything not normally admissible in a court of law, you're no longer in a court of law.
Mm.
And so that's the crux of the issue. And because of the fact that these men are not yet citizens, we think it's okay. Because they say, oh, we can go back to another country. Well, they can't go back to Egypt and Syria. They'll be tortured. So I think a lot of people in government put up with this, and the courts put up with it, because of the sheer racism involved. This wouldn't be happening if the names of the individuals affected were Smith and Adams and Jones.
Mm-hmm. So what can people do if they hear about this and want to do something about it?
Well, definitely get in touch with us. You can go to our website, which is homesnotbombs.ca, and there's lots of information both on the hunger strike as well as on what you can do to help end secret trials. I think public exposure of what is going on is the key, because the government for too long has relied on secrecy and deception, and the more that Canadians and people across this country speak up against this process, the more we will have an effect on putting it to an end. The Supreme Court will be ruling very soon on the constitutionality of these certificates as well, so there's certainly lots to get involved with. There have been demonstrations in Halifax, so hopefully folks can continue to keep up that public pressure.
Since NATO forces, including over 2,000 Canadian troops, began their military offensive in southern Afghanistan in March of 2006, the UK-based research organization, the Senlis Council, has been one of few independent voices reporting on the impacts the conflict is having on the people of this region. Since last spring, Senlis has garnered international attention for its independent reportage from Afghanistan. It remains one of few research groups producing regular reports on the situation on the ground in the southern region of the country. The Senlis Council's latest report, entitled Hearts and Minds in Southern Afghanistan, released in December, estimated that in 2006 alone, between 3,000 and 5,000 civilians were killed in southern Afghanistan and 80,000 displaced due to NATO military operations. The report specifically criticized Canada's involvement in NATO's operations and found that Canadian aid within areas secured by Canadian military forces was almost non-existent. Noreen MacDonald is the president and Southern Afghanistan project coordinator for the Senlis Council. She spoke to the Dominion from Kandahar province.
Your report is called Hearts and Minds, which has kind of been the euphemism used to describe the modern NATO war in Afghanistan. Can you tell me why you chose this particular euphemism as the subject of your report?
Our organization does research on security development and counter-narcotics issues in southern Afghanistan, and we've been doing research and reports there for quite a while. What we had discovered is, in fact, that although the military initiatives have been very successful, that in fact the local population had turned against the international community and the NATO and Canadian efforts there. The idea of a Hearts and Minds campaign is part of classical military theory, and we thought that was useful to illustrate really the deteriorating situation in southern Afghanistan, that despite our military successes, we are losing the hearts and minds of the local Afghans in Kandahar province.
Now, specifically, the report goes into detail of how the neo-Taliban, or as the Senlis report puts it, are waging a successful Hearts and Minds campaign, quite contrary to the unsuccessful campaign being waged by NATO. Can you talk a little bit about why that is, what sort of strategy that the neo-Taliban has actually engaged?
Right. Yes. One thing we have to realize, of course, is the Taliban have a very significant strategic advantage over us in a Hearts and Minds campaign, because they're from southern Afghanistan. The Taliban movement started in Kandahar and Helmand province. So they speak the language, they're part of the local tribes there. When the international community came to Afghanistan after 9/11 and deposed the Taliban government, the locals, in our research, when we asked them about it, they were very glad to see us there because the Taliban government was so marked by cruelty. And they also believed that our presence would allow them some access to economic prosperity. Because the international community has not been able to deliver economic prosperity to southern Afghanistan, and in fact, in many instances, they're worse off than before we came, the Taliban have exploited that. And that type of propaganda to say the international community doesn't care about the Afghans, we're just there for political purpose. And on top of it, our really failing and inflammatory counter-narcotics policies and the bombing campaigns have really created a really fertile ground for the Taliban propaganda against the NATO and international presence there. You know, they're very clever at their propaganda, and they're exploiting our mistakes to get support for their campaign.
Quite a bit of the report actually focuses on the issue of destruction of opium crops. I guess just in talking about how the Taliban has been able to capitalize on this, can you talk a little bit about their sort of strategy related to opium crops and opium production?
Yes. So southern Afghanistan is really dependent on the production of growing poppies for opium. It's an agricultural economy, so it's, say, 80% of the economy there. The U.S. led a very aggressive poppy crop eradication campaign in southern Afghanistan last spring. And what that meant is the poorest farmers, and many of the farmers there are very poor, had their crops destroyed and were left with no way to feed their family. Those eradication campaigns were led by Americans, but the locals can't tell the difference between Americans and Canadians. They were all foreigners to them. So what the Taliban have done is said, look, the, you know, they've left you with no other way to feed your family. They don't care about you. They're not concerned about your children not having food to eat. And on top of it, the Taliban have offered many of the young men money to fight for them, up to $200 USD a month, which is a lot of money in this part of the world. So they're very clever to look for our mistakes, things that we've done to alienate the community, to increase local support for their presence there.
The report focuses a good deal of attention on the lack of aid actually being delivered by Western aid agencies, including CEDA, Canada's International Development Agency. Particularly, I think the claim is made that aside from the lack of food aid being brought into the region, in Canada's case, no health facility within the vicinity of Kandahar has received any Canadian aid funding at the time of the report was published.
That's correct.
Now, can you talk a little bit about, some of your investigation of this and I guess why this is so, some of the reasons why so little aid might not have reached the region?
Yes. Well, in fact, what we've seen in Kandahar is that fundamentally the international community in the last 5 years in CEDA since Canada took responsibility for Kandahar have not delivered any development or food aid of any substance to Kandahar. Now, Kandahar province is, you know, about 800,000 people. I think it's about the size of your province, in fact. And they're very poor. With the crop eradication campaign, with drought, and on top of it, the bombing campaign that the U.S. started and that we were part of in June 2008, we see many people moving to very informal refugee camps with no shelter, no food. Villages were leveled in the bombing campaign, and there were no places for the civilians, the women and children and the elderly in those villages to go to. So they moved to these makeshift camps that we find just outside Kandahar City. I've been into many of them. There are some inside Kandahar City. We're the first foreigners that they've seen. We were told that fundamentally all aid was cut off to Kandahar and Helmand Province in March 2006 in the idea that if there was no aid into the camps, that people would, quote-unquote, return home. The problem is that they had no homes to return to or no way to make a living in the villages they'd been living in, either because of poppy crop eradication or because of the bombing. We consider this to be really really runs counter to our military interests because the locals are hostile to the foreign military presence, and in that case, the Canadian military presence. But it's also really a humanitarian disaster for the people of Kandahar, the people that we went there to protect and support. We've called on CEDA to launch an emergency food aid program, and we started calling for that in August when we first saw this phenomena occurring. And we more recently called for the replacement of the CEDA minister because clearly the CEDA minister is unable to provide any substantial development or food aid to Kandahar province, not only to support the Afghan people, but to support the Canadian military's efforts there.
Now, but the Canadian military has sort of responded to these sorts of calls by stating that it's impossible to provide food aid given the security situation. What's your response when you kind of hear statements like that from, for example, General Rick Hillier?
Well, in August when we first started seeing this phenomena, it was because we were getting out of our vehicles in villages to do our research, and they were asking us if we had any food because the children were starving there. And we started taking food in as part of our visits to the villages and the camps. So now we're doing food aid as part of our activities there. So I don't accept that CEDA cannot provide food aid. I don't think it's the military's responsibility. I don't think it's the general's responsibility. I think it's CEDA's responsibility to figure out how to deliver that food aid. And as I'm doing it with our small research organization on a regular basis, I don't accept CEDA's claims that it's not possible to do it.
Have you seen much of a variation in terms of different regions of the south of Afghanistan under, say, the influence of the Dutch military or the British military in terms of aid delivery?
The Dutch military are in Uruzgan and the British military in Helmand, and we're seeing the same phenomena there, unfortunately. They are all very dependent on poppy production. There's currently no alternative livelihood in place. It will take 3 or 5 years before there's an alternative livelihood. There was widespread eradication campaigns. The Americans are now pushing through chemical eradication in the next season, and neither Canada nor the British are standing up to them. We believe chemical eradication not only is not a successful counter-narcotic strategy, but it will further inflame the locals and turn them against us. So we believe that if eradication goes ahead, it should only go ahead where there's an alternative source of income, where there's food aid to replace the incomes that they're using to feed their families. And Canada should be speaking out against these failing counter-narcotics policies and providing food aid and development. As I said, not only, I mean, even if Canada doesn't want to do it because it's a humanitarian obligation, which I believe it is, they should be doing it because it's necessary to support our Canadian military, who are really, you know, they're out there in the most difficult of environments pursuing this war, and they should be being supported by the Canadian government and CETA and not being undermined by them.
Now, I guess the other kind of startling claim from the report focuses on civilian casualties in southern Afghanistan. I believe the estimate that the report puts out there is 3,000 civilians killed, largely by NATO bombing. Am I correct in that?
Yes. I was in Helmand in Kandahar when the bombing started in June. And the first bombing started really in the outskirts of Kandahar, and the bombing continued through the summer and the early fall, and there's sporadic bombing now. What's happening is villages are being bombed without provisions made for what the civilians in those villages, where they're supposed to go, or what's supposed to happen with casualties, and they're going to these camps. I've spoken to dozens of families who, you know, have lived in those villages for generations. They've always had proper homes. They're living under tarps in the bitter, bitter desert cold. When you go to the Kandahar hospital, the hospital itself is without heat, it's without food, it's without medicine, it's without blood, without proper medical personnel. And that is where the innocent casualties of our bombing campaign are forced to go to for medical aid. Additionally, I believe that you've heard the reports that there are people from the city of Kandahar who are accidentally shot by the Canadian military in various events surrounding the suicide bombings in Kandahar, and that's the hospital where those people are going. So I've seen a young man with 3 bullet wounds in his head accidentally shot by the Canadian military, and he can receive no treatment at the Kandahar hospital. And the Kandahar hospital has been completely neglected again by CETA, and it's the only place for the people of Afghanistan to go when they are confronted, you know, with casualties from this bombing. And if we are going to continue with bombing campaigns, if we think that's necessary, and we never had a proper conversation in Canada about whether we are willing to engage in a war that includes these type of bombing campaigns of villages, if we are going to be involved in it, then I think we have to make proper provision for the civilians who have to leave their villages, who have no homes, and for the people who are suffering casualties. And that's just not being done. I mean, once again, from a humanitarian point of view, I don't think any Canadian would accept that. And from the point of view of supporting our military, we're not doing what we need to do to make sure that the local population continues to support our presence there and helps us in our fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Much of the media coverage of the latest military operation, I believe it's called Bazouk, has sort of focused on NATO forces taking a sort of so-called soft approach. Is this accurate? Are the same sort of, tactics being used in this latest military operation that's been taking place in the South?
Well, at the moment, there's not a lot of Taliban assaults going on in southern Afghanistan, which can either be because of, you know, Ramadan and Eid or the winter cold, or because the military has, in fact, been successful in beating them back. I mean, there's varying opinions about that. But it's a moment where NATO is not being confronted with a lot of Taliban assaults, which they were in the spring, summer, and early fall. So it's difficult to compare what we saw in the summer with what we're seeing now. It's widely expected that there'll be a significant Taliban offensive in the spring. So, for example, people were shown returning to the Panjwai where the bombing was. The problem is that those people are being returned to the Panjwai where their homes have been destroyed. There's no effective reconstruction effort, no aid going in there. And if the Taliban return there in the spring, I believe there will be bombing there again without any provision made for them. So, once again, it's not a military problem. The military are pursuing a military campaign with success. It's a question of a political problem. These are decisions that should be made by our Prime Minister, our Cabinet, and CETA. And it's not correct in any way to lay the blame for the shortcomings of our work in southern Afghanistan and the campaign in southern Afghanistan at the feet of the military. It's a political decision. It's the government that's not having a proper conversation with the Americans about the bombing. They're not having a proper conversation with the Americans about eradication and providing them with an alternative livelihood. You know, we've asked the government to allow us to run pilot projects down there for the farmers to grow opium poppies for the medicines morphine and codeine. And that happens in Turkey and India. It's not a new idea. There's a global shortage of morphine and codeine. We want to launch a Buy Afghan Morphine campaign. And the Canadian government is silent on that and has ceded counter-narcotics policy to the Americans with a very heavy negative effect on the Canadian military.
Chris Sands, who's sort of been writing a number of pieces for the Dominion, which is the online newspaper that this radio program is being produced for, he interviewed a number of Afghan MPs who basically, in response to the civilian casualties as a result of the bombing campaigns, predicted a quote, very big war. Now, if this is the sort of sentiment that's coming from MPs, from the mainstream, I guess, or at least the government, how is the instability that's being seen in Kandahar, does it have much likelihood of spreading beyond the south?
Well, I think there's widespread concern here amongst the Afghan population and amongst the international community about what the spring will bring. Many of us believe, and I believe from our research on the ground, that we will see a large Taliban offensive against in Helmand and against Kandahar City in the spring. You know, when the Taliban took over before, they took Helmand and then took Kandahar City, and then eventually there was a fight between the North and the South, the Taliban and the Northern Alliance, and the Taliban took Kabul City. I mean, the government, Karzai's government, has secure control of Kabul City. How the Taliban's psychological control has been spreading north steadily in the last month. So they are fighting in Helmand and Kandahar province, but they are psychologically controlling, without any fighting, several of the other southern provinces. You know, I believe even the military feels like time is running out here, and unless we turn the tide of local support in the south back to support the international presence, we will psychologically lose the south, and it will be another endless Afghan war, as there have been many before. You know, the British and the Russians have been here before and experienced the same phenomena, that despite our high-tech, highly trained, very courageous military, we are fighting, you know, a local insurgency in their own territory. And as I said, they speak the language. They know the local customs. They know the villages. This is a very, very difficult war we're fighting. And unless we're extremely clever, which we have not been in many instances, as I stated, we are going to see the situation spiraling out of control. I think the international community is distracted by Iraq because of the difficulties in Iraq, and Afghanistan's being neglected. It's being neglected financially from a development and aid point of view. And we do that at our great peril. And as you can see, we're suffering significant Canadian military losses, and as our report stated, without sufficient support from the Canadian government and from the international community at large to the local Afghans.
I guess just a final question. You've touched on this somewhat, but it's been reported in I believe, the Montreal Gazette that some members of the Karzai government have called Senlis's reports unconstitutional. What kind of response has occurred as a result of Senlis's findings from both the Karzai government and the NATO force operating in southern Afghanistan?
You're going to have to repeat that question because you broke up after the Montreal Gazette.
Sure. Well, the Montreal Gazette, I believe in an article, an interview with you, noted that an Afghan MP had claimed that your reports were unconstitutional. What basically has been the response from both the NATO forces and from the Karzai government in response to the reports you've been putting out about the situation in southern Afghanistan?
I think many Afghans appreciate the fact that we're reporting on what Afghans are saying and experiencing in southern Afghanistan. I mean, there's been no official response. You have to understand that the Karzai government is entirely financed by the international community. President Karzai did complain about the bombing campaign. He has complained repeatedly about the civilian casualties, but he's not the one who is making the decisions about counter-narcotics strategy here. That's the Americans. He's not the one who's making the decisions about the bombing campaigns here. That's the Americans. So it would be false to lay at the doorstep of the Karzai government any of the difficulties that we're seeing in southern Afghanistan. They only have the resources that come to them from the international community, and the resources they get are quite specific in how they're going to be used. So even if the Karzai government wanted to put more development and aid into southern Afghanistan, they don't have financial resources independent of the international community to do that. If they wanted to stop the bombing campaigns in southern Afghanistan, they don't have the political abilities to do that. And I think, you know, we've seen early signs of democracy here. There's been elections. Karzai's been elected. A parliament's been elected. But those are really the tools of democracy. We don't have a real democracy here. So it'd be unfair to say that President Karzai is responsible for this situation. The response in southern Afghanistan is being run by the international community. And the Canadian, Canada has taken responsibility for Kandahar. And we are calling on the international community to do a better job in working with the Afghan government to address these issues.
Okay. Noreen McDonald, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks to you as well.
That was Stu Neatby in an interview with Noreen McDonald, President and Southern Afghanistan Coordinator for the research group The Senless Council. For more information on The Senless Council, check out senlesscouncil.org. And last up for today is Pierre Loisel's interview with independent journalist John Almer on sanctions against Palestine.
It's important for people to understand that the establishment of Israel was that of a settler state, superimposing itself militarily, politically, and economically at the expense of the land, lives, and resources of the indigenous population, the Palestinians. In Palestine, the establishment of Israel in 1948 meant the dispossession and mass deportation of more than 1 million Palestinians from their cities and villages, massacres of civilians, and the razing to the ground of hundreds of Palestinian villages. Essentially, the beginning of a program of ethnic cleansing that continues to this day. Now, the face of the occupation has been using various strategies over the years, some more subtle than the obvious overt warfare waged on the Palestinian people. I would like to welcome John Almer, currently joining us via cell phone from Gaza City in occupied Palestine. Thanks for making the time for us, John.
It's my pleasure, Pierre.
Now, John, a really important new development in the occupation has been the sanctions regime. Now, Canada was one of the first countries, if not the first country, to condemn the newly elected government in January 2006. Canada has maintained that not one red penny should go into the hands of the democratically elected Hamas government. This position is behind the current economic embargo. Tell us about the sanctions regime and how it's affecting the daily lives of Palestinians.
In the most fundamental sense, you had unemployment here in the Gaza Strip above 70% before the sanctions regime, which you rightly stated Canada was front and center in supporting. So you already had what was being described as an economic crisis and the World Bank described as the greatest economic collapse in modern history. This is the conditions upon which, you know, as well as the Israeli occupation going on 40 years, the violence, 700 dead Palestinians in 2006 alone, a year that most people would say was a quiet year. This is the context that the sanctions have been applied to. And so with 70+% unemployment, those 30% that are employed are actually employed for a larger percentage of the population than just that, because they're supporting their brothers and their parents and what have you, and this is what's been cut off. So what was already a desperate situation has been amplified. If you were to go out on the street right now and ask Palestinians what the number one issue is for them, although while the bullets are flying, they might say the factional violence, the issue is the sanctions regime. So in fact, Canada is at front and center of what Palestinians are considering the number one issue on the agenda right now. Palestinians haven't been paid. Nobody can afford to, quite simply, feed their families. Nobody can afford to go to work because you can't even afford the transit regularly to go into work when you're not getting a paycheck. And so what does this mean? It has many consequences, including a fundamental social fabric consequences of what do you do when you have no power, no heating gas, no cooking gas, no salary, and there's factional fighting. You don't do anything. And that, you know, that constantly, day in and day out, is really eroding the Palestinian society in a way that has been predicted for quite some time and by people who are paid and employed to monitor these kind of things, such as the UN agencies that time and again warn of the catastrophe that's impending here. In what is, you know, what Amir Haas, the intrepid Israeli reporter, called, you know, the great human experiment here in Gaza, where you have 1.5 million people in an isolated enclave being starved, bombed, attacked daily for their whole lives with no way of getting out, with a population that's due to double in the next 20 years. It's a human experiment. When will they start to fight? Well, there's your answer. Now we know when they'll start to fight because the fighting has started, and the sanctions regime, these things are all interconnected. The desperation that people are dealing with, the survival mechanisms that have been implemented in people's lives can't help but contribute to the sense of urgency that is being exacted on the streets through guns rather than through negotiations of a peaceful national unity government. The sanctions regime has been a catastrophe. The United Nations duly acknowledged that it's the first of its kind against an already occupied population. Sanctions and occupation, the two most violent forms of international relations being inflicted upon Palestinians. Like I said, you don't want to be too dramatic, but it's an utter catastrophe.
John, you wrote a forthcoming book with Anthony Fenton. The current working title is The Afghanistan Adventure, Canada's Foreign Policy for the 21st Century. Now, last month, Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister Peter MacKay, he was in Israel, and he declared that, quote, "We are improving the effectiveness of our international assistance and are bringing new force to our diplomatic effort abroad." How is Canada's foreign policy for the 21st century reflected in MacKay's rhetoric?
The idea is what the Liberals called the three Ds: development, defense, and diplomacy. Defense being, of course, what we would call offense. And so for Canada and for the foreign policy establishment, they constantly say we don't make any distinction between the three Ds. Sometimes it requires defense, aka offense, like Afghanistan. Sometimes it requires diplomacy, as in Palestine, and sometimes it requires development, as in Haiti. But all three of them are Canadian interventions against the will of the populations being imposed upon. So what role is Canada playing here in their development assistance? Well, they're cutting it off to the Palestinian people, not one red cent to Hamas, which, you know, would be good if Hamas was an abstraction rather than what it actually is, which is a collection of human beings, namely Palestinians, who are being punished collectively for, as we said earlier, for their democratic choices. So instead of giving money to the Palestinian people, what's Canada giving money to? Well, Peter MacKay came here and announced he's giving $1.2 million to the Al-Muntar crossing into the Gaza Strip. What is that? That's one of the holes in the ghetto through which modest provisions are stuffed to the Palestinians who are otherwise starving. That's what Canada's doing. People think that part of the security infrastructure of Israel is building this ghetto apparatus. It's only partially correct. American taxpayers are paying for the ghettos to be made. Canadian taxpayers are paying for the holes in the ghettos through which the food is going to be stuffed. This is where Canadian development aid goes to. Where does it go in Haiti? It goes to training security forces that are, to put it mildly, dubious. Where is it going in Afghanistan? It's going to hire private security guards to guard contracts that are enriching Canadian corporations. You know, whenever we're talking, it's always important to mention, and our book will numerous times, mention that CETA boasts that 85 cents on the dollar of every development dollar stays in a Canadian pocket. So it's always, of course, whenever we're talking about development assistance, it's immediately important to talk about it in those terms, but it's also important to put it in real terms. Peter MacKay's rhetorical flourishes are talking about something like $27 million in Canadian aid to the Palestinians. And with all due respect, $27 million being a lot of money, it's a pittance in real terms. You know, the Iraq war, Bush is about to, you know, ask for $100 billion for that war. The Americans just gave $1 billion to Lebanon, Comprador government. So for Canada to give $1 million to build a crossing or to give $27 million to finance security forces or what have you, it's really not all that big. But what is big is that Canada is using this human rights catastrophe, which history will not look well upon. There's no doubt that the historical record that's being created out of the Gaza Strip will be analyzed by historians for generations to come as a massive crime, and the human experiment is all right here in front of everybody's eyes to watch, and people have been watching it happen for a long time, and there's a lot of very good data on the destruction of life here in the Gaza Strip. It's Peter McKay using real people's lives to play politics, when really Canada's really not ever been a legitimate player for justice here in the Palestinian arena.
There's definitely blood on the hands of Canadians in this affair. Unfortunately, John, we're quickly running out of time. Anything else you'd like to throw out there before we let you go?
No, I appreciate you having me on the program, Pierre. I think it's important for Canadians to remember, oftentimes they say, how do we interact with the Israel-Palestine conflict? It's happening so far away and doesn't seem to have anything to do with us. But as I mentioned, the number one issue on the ground here in the Gaza Strip is also Canada's number one diplomatic priority here in the Palestinian territories. And so lobbying and being active on the government to reverse the policy that is the number one issue for Palestinians on the ground is something that Canadians can interact with in an intimate way on the Israel-Palestine conflict, which will have very real implications for the people on the ground here.
John, we look forward to further reports, your forthcoming book, and obviously you have some upcoming speaking engagements here in Canada when you get back. Thanks for joining us, and be safe, John.
My pleasure, Pierre. Thanks for having me.
That was independent journalist John Elmer. If you'd like to learn more about what John was talking about, you can check out his website, www.FromOccupiedPalestine.org. And if you'd like to know more about anything you've heard on the show today or more grassroots news from across the country, you can check out the Dominion newspaper at dominionpaper.ca. And that's it for our show today. You've been listening to Dominion Radio at CKDU 88.1. You can hear us on the first Friday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. Our next show is on Friday, March 2nd. I'm Hillary Lindsay.
And I'm Pierre Loiselle. Thanks also goes out to Stu Neatby, who helped produce tonight's episode. Have a good day or evening.